Welcome to Nature Now, an original production by KPTZ Volunteers. Nature Now is a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners. Care of Nature Now at kptz.org.
Hello, this is Nature Now for the first week in September with Mary Robson and Charlie Fleischman. It's hard to believe we have found ourselves past Labor Day and on into the gallop of fall. Clear air finds us breathing deeply and gratefully, without smoke for a while. And this week brings the Wooden Boat Festival, September 7th, 8th, and 9th. This is a celebration of maritime skill. But for nature now, I also think it's a thankful time. Consider all the trees that provided the wood for these exceptional boats. There would be no Wooden Boat Festival without trees. And you heard it here. As usual, we have a mystery sound. This one was recorded by our guest today, Bob Jepperson, up on Fidalgo Island. And just to clue you in, this is a juvenile specimen of what it is. So we will start with observations. Charlie Fleischman will help me read these. The first is, I'm calling this, Red-Tailed Hawk Captures Lunch. And seeing this hawk happened as just a remarkable bit of timing. I was driving. I approached a place where a red-tailed hawk had just scooped up a rodent from an open field on my left. The hawk flew up with it, fast but not high. It flew over the hood of my car about 5 feet up. This whole encounter took only seconds. I was going 40 miles an hour and completely surprised. And because it was headed across the road, the bird aimed at a tree branch. It moved quickly enough just to stay away from the car. And as I glanced up, every feather under the wings and the spread tail looked as clear as a close-up photograph. The wingspread seemed over 3 feet. And the rodent, which frankly looked like a rat, was firmly held in the talons as the bird scooted over my hood. I read a study while writing this which stated that red-tailed hawks easily get used to car traffic. I have certainly seen them standing in trees along roadsides, but I have to testify, this bird was more used to car traffic than I am to being under the flight of a red tail. It was quite startling and fascinating. And on we go.
Bobcats moving around Calla Point. Valerie Parker related watching bobcats move through her wooded garden in Calla Point for the last 2 years. The most recent sighting was last week. I was out in the vegetable garden during the day and it watched me through a hedge, she said. Last summer, she noted seeing one cross the garden, walk over a deck, and pause at a low flight of stairs. Her next-door neighbors have also met this one or another, usually toward dusk. Calla Point wooded homes are relatively close together and don't immediately seem to be good bobcat terrain. Deborah Kelso, the Nature Now wildlife specialist, suggested that these reports are definitely credible. She said it may be a young one looking for its own territory. Valerie Parker added, well, the rabbit population is down.
And another thing I read about bobcats said they are particularly fond of rabbits. It seems to me that makes very good sense. They're probably easy to catch, and they're certainly full of meat. And going on with bumblebee and local flowers.
Most of us think of threatened or endangered species as having fur and 4 feet. It's more difficult to consider the problems of insects, such as the bumblebee. Among the many honeybees visiting Garden Cosmos buzzed one bumblebee, quite furry with black face, bright yellow center parts, ending in black. Perhaps to remind us of their importance, one writer looking at their ample fuzziness said that they are the panda of the bee world. With a quick view, it was not possible to identify which of the several dozen species of local bumblebees it might have been.
Bumblebees are important pollinators of wild flowering plants and crops. They are raised and delivered to greenhouses for tomato pollination, though out in the wild they reach many plants. Honeybees, by the way, do not pollinate tomatoes. These bumblebees are native to North America, unlike the imported honeybees. They are social, but they have a different life than honeybees. They live in colonies, but in much smaller numbers than honeybees. Honeybees may have 10,000 individuals in one hive. Bumblebees live with 50 to 500 in one colony. The queen and the workers die at the end of the summer. A new fertilized queen will survive and start a new nest in spring. They generally nest in the ground and often use abandoned rodent tunnels. Nothing in nature is ever wasted. And I saw some research on bumblebees going on the Upper Dungeness Trail as about five people from WSU were coming down from Marmot Pass where they had been studying and noting bumblebees. Watch for them because it's very important that they continue going. We are going to talk with Bob Jepperson this afternoon. He walks, he observes, he photographs, and he records what he sees in the natural life near his home on Fidalgo Island. He wrote and published a very well-received book, Wild Love Story, an illustrated book about his findings. It is not X-rated, by the way. It is rated as fascinating. Welcome, Bob. Hi.
Hi, Mary. Good to talk to you.
Thank you. It's good to have you back. For the people who may not have heard you before, I'd like you to describe where your park is that you visit. It's a number of acres, and it is accessible to people from Anacortes also. Is that correct?
Oh, sure.
Okay.
Yeah, and I have a long history of visiting forests. I lived in one for 10 years, and I always have a place nearby that I can see wild things, and I'm lucky here on Fidalgo Island because Anacortes owns 2,800 acres of forest land and a trail system through it, and it is open to the public. There's some rules, but they're not too restrictive.
Is it easy to access by signage, or does someone know where they're actually headed?
They do, and the trails are now available in three maps online.
Oh, good.
And they're also available locally in a number of places on paper. Three different paper maps, and they go with the different sections. One of them is the Little Cranberry Lake section.
Mm-hmm.
That's where I tend to go because it has beaver ponds. Then there's the Heart Lake section, and then there's the Whistle Lake section.
Great. So it is a place for someone else, perhaps, to find their spot to visit and check into.
Yeah, because some people prefer to go to the places where they can see a long ways, the viewpoints. Of course, we have mountain bikers. We have a lot of runners. We have walkers. We have dog walkers. Dogs are allowed but need to be on a leash. And then there's a few of us that are there to get close to the residents. That's what I'm into.
So the first resident we were going to talk about this afternoon and that we will talk about is the beaver and the beaver ponds. Last time we spoke, it was spring, and things were just beginning to pop. So what we need to know now is how did the beaver ponds change over what has been a warm and rather dry summer?
Yes, and of course, the beaver ponds serve a magnificent purpose. They hold water that would otherwise run off. When the beaver were trapped out in this area, our largest pond, which is over 15 acres in size, would have been a dried-up stream meandering through the forest. Instead, we've got this large pond covered with pond lilies, attracting all sorts of aquatic and terrestrial and airborne species. So we owe the beavers a lot, and anywhere where beavers can live, I hope people can make room for them because they just create wonderful habitat. Now, how has it changed this summer?
Yes.
Well, the ponds are still, here we are in early September, the ponds that are of the right depth are still covered with pond lilies, which adds another layer of richness to the environment. A lot of species take advantage of those pond lilies.
Are they still green at this point? They haven't,
oh, good point.
They haven't changed?
Oh, they have changed. And
okay.
It isn't because they're drying out, because their feet are very wet. They're rooted underwater. There's a network of roots that, a tangle of them that goes all across the bottom of the pond, and then they send up shoots in the spring, leaf shoots and blossom shoots. And then those shoots, those stalks keep growing and actually elevate most of the leaves above the pond. I would say 1 to 3 feet above the pond. So it's kind of like a miniature forest. And right now they're turning colors and drying out. The leaves have changed. Some of them, most of them probably, have changed from green to a yellow-brown color. And they look like wadded-up brown paper on the ends of stalks.
By wintertime,
they'll be gone, and the pond will just be clear totally of them.
Since there are so many of them, when they actually get to the end of their life and the leaves die, do they just drop to the bottom of the pond again?
Yeah. They do, and you wouldn't know in the wintertime that there were any there. So it's just an amazing transition.
And you're right in fall transition now. Have there been any particular effects of the warm weather and the droughts on trees around you?
Well, younger cedar trees are being stressed. Those that live on thin soils or well-drained soils, we have quite a few that have turned red. That happened last year, too. Oso berries, some of them also have dead leaves on them now. So this isn't a new thing. We've had a number of dry summers in a row, and in fact, this one, based on one thing that I watch, is not as dry as last year. I keep my eyes on a little pond that, when it's filled, is probably 16 inches deep. Right now, it's down to 8 feet. In diameter and about 4 inches deep. It's still home to about a dozen red-legged frogs, little tiny ones under an inch long, this year's frogs and last year's frogs, and there's probably a dozen salamander larvae in this 4 inches of water, too. And last year at this time, my field notes say that it was completely dry and cracked mud, so not quite as dry as last year.
Well, both the red-legged frogs and the larval forms and the small ones, they are going to live over till winter is over, yes? And
they'll be
live ones, the adults, in the next spring.
Yes, although the red-legged frogs don't breed until they're at least two, so they've got a ways to go. If that pond does dry out like it did last year, they're mobile. Those larvae of the salamanders have 4 legs. They still have gills, but they are mobile.
Most of the larvae I've ever met had no legs at all, so that is pretty interesting.
Yeah.
Okay, so both salamanders and red-legged frogs give us a sense of the greater amphibious world that we'd like to know more about, so I appreciate that.
Yeah.
Are the beavers still around?
Oh, yes. In fact, it looks like one new lodge under construction. Each of our beavers' ponds has a lodge on it, and a second one is being created on a pond. It looks like it anyway. I'm kind of holding judgment, but it looks like they're going to add a second home on that pond. And a good time to see them. I meet people frequently who've been walking the trails for years and say they've never seen a beaver. So I give them a suggestion on where to go and what time to be there about dusk. And boom, they see a beaver the first night because they're out there and they may see you first and tail slap. Right now, I frequently see them towing a pond lily leaf on the stalk. They hold it in their mouth and they swim somewhere and then they dive underwater, and I'm not sure what they're doing other than eating it. They are farmers, you know. Beavers create the pond and then the pond lilies come in and then they eat part of the crop.
That is news to me. I knew that they were not carnivorous, but I wasn't sure what they're eating at this time of year. So
yeah, they love those pond lilies.
And if they're building a new lodge, or perhaps building a new lodge, does that indicate that there's going to be more beavers added to the group? Has the group gotten larger?
I think so. The pond that's getting the second lodge, if it is a lodge, has the youngest lodge on it anyway. So it's the place where people are seeing most of the trees being chewed on. We'll just have to see what happens, but it's gonna be interesting to watch them.
Well, beaver have to keep chewing or they lose the health of their teeth, right?
Right, and they don't choose the easiest trees to chew on. Cedars split easily, but they're very fibrous, and they chew. I'd say most of the chewing is on cedars, and second is probably hemlocks, and then third and fourth would be alders and willows.
Hmm.
And they'll eat the bark off of all those, but they seem to prefer alders and willows, especially willows.
Willows may be present a lot around the pond, for one thing, because they like water, so that may actually, it all goes together.
So. Yes, although once the beavers have been there for a few years, it's hard to find a live willow. They tend to spoil their own habitat eventually.
Well, it's one of the things that troubles actual watchers about beavers, saying, what the heck are they about?
Yeah.
So other things that you have been observing other than the beaver and the way drought is affecting your area, you have continued to listen to great horned owls.
And barred owls.
Right.
And I would be glad to listen to more species, but the woods that I visit just has great horns and bards. In the past, people reported saw-whets, and we still have saw-whets on this island, but I think the barred owls have probably impacted them. They're doing so well.
The barred owl is a fairly aggressive territorial bird, isn't it? I mean, I know they've moved from the east to get here.
Yeah, I wouldn't say they're more aggressive than other owls in terms of protecting territory, but they're such generalists in their diet. So they'll eat aquatic species, and they also eat terrestrial species, mammals and birds. And they just do very well because they have such broad tastes. They're not specialists like spotted owls.
Well, and the great horned owl, which we have the sound of, we're going to take a little break here and put the great horned owl sound in. So what are the great horned owls up to? They were mating and nesting last time we talked.
Let me say one thing about that recording. This is the time of year when a lot of people mention they hear screech owls. And we do have screech owls at this elevation, but often the screeching owls turn out to be young great horned owls. They're reminding their parents that they're still hungry. And it's a fairly loud sound for a juvenile bird. It can be quite a thing to hear in the middle of the night in a forest area when you hear a great horned baby screeching. What are they up to now? Well, this is an interesting transition time. The family that I follow most closely fledged in May, and so by late June, those juveniles, and there were two this year, would be independent hunters. And after they become independent hunters and the parents no longer have to feed anyone but themselves, then the parents get a moment of freedom, and they keep in touch vocally. But about 3 weeks ago, great horned owls started hooting a lot, especially in the evening and overnight. And what they're doing right now is establishing their winter hunting grounds, which are much larger than their nesting grounds. And so I call it their advertising exchanges. And they're close enough to each other that they stay in contact. And they call from different places around what they want for their winter territory. And sometimes there are border skirmishes because things are in flux. There's new young owls that also need territories. The sound they make is, for a great horned owl, there are true hooting owls. And their call is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Hoo, 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 hoo. Most of them make the five-syllable call, but some don't. And let's play a recording of a pair of owls that I used to call Mr. and Mrs. Orthodox because they both give the five-note call. Now I call them Mr. and Mrs. E, and the E stands for enunciate. And I want you to listen in the recording to how clearly both of them say all five notes of their call very clearly. And this is only about 6.5 seconds.
Okay.
Hoo,
And at this point, we have taken ourselves as far down the path as we can today. Believe it or not, we are right at the end of talking. It feels like we just started. And I think that what we have time for is to talk a little bit more about the nature of the territory for the great horned owls. Do they combine their territory with the barred owls, or do they want it all for themselves?
The great horns and the bards can exist within earshot of each other. But I've watched barred owls have to give up a traditional nesting site to a great horn. The great horns outweigh them 2-1. And so if the great horns want a nesting territory, they can take it.
Aha. And so essentially then the barred owls need to move on and start somewhere else. So
yes.
Okay.
And they're fairly adaptable. One set of barred owls now has a new set of barred owls between them. So if a new set can establish a nesting territory and finds an appropriate nest site, it can happen. Around one beaver pond, we have at least 5 barred owl nesting territories.
That's a lot.
And come winter, they're going to have much larger territories. So they, too, will get vocal. Late September, early October is when I really start hearing the advertising calls of the barred owls.
Okay, we are at a place where we can anticipate talking with you again in winter to see who is where and what they're doing, and if you've named anybody a different name. And I very much appreciate your being part of this today. It takes us a place we can't get without you. So thank you very much, Bob. We've appreciated it. Okay.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks, Mary.
Okay, bye.
Bye.
Mystery sound. Well, Bob described the mystery sound when he talked about young horned owls. And since he described that, I'm going to add information about another mysterious animal reported today, the bobcat. Bobcats, by the way, are easily distinguished from cougars by their short tails, which gives them their common name. Mature bobcats weigh about 22 pounds or more and can live up to 7 years in the wild. They have distinctive black ear tips, and they adapt to edge environments, so seeing them near houses is not unusual. They are completely carnivorous and eat anything they can catch, including fawns and other animals larger than themselves. They live throughout North America and are not considered endangered, although they can be eliminated if their habitat is destroyed by buildings or agriculture. Events. Tuesday, September 11th, there's a work party on the Lower Donovan Creek Preserve, sponsored by Jefferson Land Trust. This roughly runs from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m., and for questions or more information, call the Land Trust at 379-9501. Wednesday, September 5th, as usual, the Audubon Center at Railroad Bridge Park in Squim had a morning bird walk. I hope they had good bird watching. They do this every Wednesday from 8:30 to 10 a.m., and the next one available for your enjoyment and learning will be Wednesday, September 12th. And here's one that is kind of far away, but I'm announcing it because it fits in with our discussion about bumblebees. Thursday, September 27th. Get it on your calendar. Tor Hansen, who has written a new book, Buzz, The Nature and Necessity of Bees, will be speaking at 6:30 p.m. in the Chimicum High School Auditorium. This is sponsored by the Jefferson County Library, and he has written a couple of other books, one called Feather, another one on seeds, and he is a very well-renowned speaker who has spoken all over the United States. So that is something not to miss. Tor Hansen on Buzz, The Nature and Necessity of Bees. We hope you have enjoyed this program of authentic, live, and eclectic reports. Thanks to Charlie Fleischman for engineering our words and sounds and for his years of involvement and improvement to Nature Now. Nature Now airs at noon on Wednesdays with repeats here on KPTZ on Thursdays at 5 p.m. and Saturdays at 12:30 p.m. Podcasts are also available on the website at www.kptz.org.
Nature Now is produced by Nan Evans and edited by Charlie Fleischman.
This week's closing music is Eager Beaver, performed by the Stan Kenton Orchestra.